want to point out in this chapter is that John reveals here that there will be a new heaven and a new earth. How many of you like new things? If I told you I have a car for you, what would you say? That sounds nice. But what if I said, I have a car for you. I found it in the alley the other day. The windshield's all busted out. The doors are all rusted up. The tires are all flat. And I think it has 350,000 miles on it. And oh, by the way, it doesn't have an engine. And I think it was made in 1945. You would say, well, I think you can keep your car. But what if I said, I have a car for you, and get your hopes up, and I say it's a brand new 2021 Ford Mustang GT, 10 miles on the odometer, leather seats, brand new. What would you think about that? You would say, I'll take it. You see, there's something about new. What if I said to you, I have a pair of shoes for you. I found them outside, laying on the sidewalk. They smell a little bit. I don't know who wore them or why they don't wear them anymore, but I have them and I'm giving them to you. You don't want those shoes, but if I said, I have a brand new pair of Air Jordans fresh off the rack from the mall, and they're exactly your size, you would say, I'll take them. That sounds really nice. This passage opens with a startling observation. John says, let this sink in. He saw a new heaven and a new earth, which means a new planet Earth and a new solar system. Brand new. What would that be like? A brand new solar system, a brand new Earth. And he gives the reason for this colossal change. He says it's because the former heaven and the former earth passed away, which means they went away, which means they had gone away and needed to be replaced. Not everyone was cast into the lake of fire at the great white throne judgment. Some people who had ruled and reigned with Christ and followed God by faith throughout history are still around and need a place to go. And the place to go is not back to the old earth, but to a new heaven and a new earth. This new creation was an astounding sight to take in, but it was not actually unheard of. It wasn't something that John didn't realize was going to happen. It was just amazing to behold. But in the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, the prophet writes, God says, behold, I will create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered or come to mind. So all of you pack rats and hoarders out there who like to hold on to memorabilia, hold on to it as long as you want. But there's coming a day, no matter how long you hold on to things, they won't come to mind. They won't matter. In fact, the entire world that we live in today will not come to mind. Isaiah 66:22 also says, as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your descendants and your name remain. Meaning, when I make the new heaven and the new earth, the new solar system, the new world, those will never end. They will have no ending point. So to complete God's full restoration of his kingdom, he doesn't only need to remove Satan and cast him to the lake of fire. He doesn't only need to remove the Antichrist and the false prophet. He doesn't only need to remove all non-believers and evil influences and throw them into the lake of fire. There's still something that remains, and that is the material world itself. Now, matter is not evil, but the material world is affected by evil and is under the curse like our own physical bodies are. And so for God to complete his redemption and his restoration of all things, he must also remove evil from the world, the material world. Now, Bible teachers debate whether God will entirely eradicate this current material universe and then create out of nothing something brand new. That's one option. They also suggest that it's possible for God to unmake, to dismantle the old solar system and Earth to its very core, strip out evil and recreate with that original matter a new heaven and a new earth. Turn, if you are interested, to 2 Peter chapter 3. In 2 Peter chapter 3, we read about the same thing that will happen. Verses 10 to 13, Peter writes, "The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Looking for the and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat." So he is speaking here of the destruction and then the restoration of a new kingdom of God. At issue here is the material world entirely eradicated, or is it dismantled and restored? Either way, this is a very radical transformation. And the fact is, the words given in Revelation 21 and in 1 Peter 3, none of them are specific or technical enough to answer that question very well. What we do know is that the new heaven and the new earth will be so entirely different, they will qualify as brand new. If you want to know what I think, and you can disagree with me, I am going to probably suggest that the new heaven and the new world will be a dismantling of and reformation of the current matter that God has created already in our universe and in our world. I say that because 1 Corinthians 15:42 to 49 describes what happens to our physical bodies. Our physical bodies are going to be resurrected, Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians 15. They will be resurrected and will indeed be the same body that we died with, that we lived this life with. That body will be resurrected. But at the same time, Paul also teaches that there is a physical kind of body and there is a spiritual kind of glorified body, and they are not the same, meaning you will have the same body, but it won't be the same kind of body, if that makes sense. It will be same but different. Jesus resurrected with his very body. The very scars of his death were there. It was him. It looked like him. It was him. And it carried the vestiges of his former life as well. But it also was a glorified and different body. This also reminds us of what Paul teaches in Romans 8, 18 through 23, when he teaches that all of creation groans and travails, is in birth pangs, labor, as it were, waiting for God to redeem his people and remove sin from them and restore them to a perfect state. Because it says that the creation of God, the material world, will experience the same kind of transformation when that happens. And it does fit very well with this idea of the same kind, but different and new, and also restoration. The whole point of salvation is not to discard and come up with something new, the point of salvation is to rescue and restore, to renew, to make new again what was destroyed in the fall. In John's opening description, he also noticed another obvious omission. John is good at this in Revelation. He takes in a scene, he sees and he savors what he saw, and then he tells you the things that stand out. There are sometimes things we want to know, like, where are the animals and what kind of animals? Can we eat animals? And he doesn't really answer that question. We have to wait to get there to find out. But what we do know is what John saw and said. And the thing that shocked him here is there was a new heaven, new solar system. There was a new planet Earth. But there weren't any seas. There was no sea anymore. What does that mean? It does not mean there is no water. There will be water. In fact, we know in Revelation 21:6 and 22:1, we'll get there later, there are springs of fresh water. There are rivers in this new earth. There will be water sources. But these massive bodies of water we call oceans today, and perhaps even the freshwater seas, maybe even lakes, I don't know, are in large part a result of God's judgment. They represent God's judgment, not just figuratively, but actually, because are in large part the result of the Noahic flood. God's judgment on the world that reshaped the topography of the world and gave us these massive bodies of water. John said there will be no more large standing bodies of water like this that remind us of God's judgment and the flood. These will be gone from the new earth. Then in verse 2, John saw a special city that he identified as the New Jerusalem. Calling this city by this name connects it to the Jerusalem that we know today, which is the established and cherished center of government and worship for Israel. The city will serve the same purpose on an enlarged scale when Christ rules and reigns in the millennium for all the people of God. The city of Jerusalem will be the center of worship and government for the world. And in the eternal state, it also will be the center of government and worship and the seat of God's presence in the new earth. Forever. Like the new heaven and earth already described and the resurrected glorified bodies that we'll receive from God, the word new does not necessarily mean something that was out of just nowhere, brand new, created, but new to us, new to the earth, though connected to the former one. A restored but superior version of the city, not entirely new. One commentator points out, ancient Jewish texts frequently speak of a pre-existent heavenly counterpart to the earthly Jerusalem, a city that God has founded and built already in heaven. Jesus alludes to this sometimes in his teaching ministry. When the time is right, God will reveal that city by bringing it to the earth and establishing it here as the center of his restored people, Israel, and all the nations of the world will come to it to worship and serve him. In fact, both Paul and the writer of Hebrews actually indicate this. Look at Galatians 4:26. Paul refers to the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all, referring to all people who follow Christ by faith alone, as Pastor Christian preached about several weeks ago. The writer of Hebrews, you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, This also, the book of Hebrews, refers to Abraham, who looked for a city whose builder and maker was God. God took him to the place where the city was supposed to be. He died having never seen the city. But guess what? The city is going to be there. But it's not a one that people have made. It's a city that God made, and he will bring it to the earth, having been foreshadowed by the one we know today. This city will descend downward from above onto the earth, where it will be situated for eternity. One way of looking at it in the book of Revelation is this way. Recall the numerous examples of John showing us what he saw in the temple and the throne room of heaven. We would get sneak peeks up in the throne room of God, in the tabernacle, the temple that is there. That is, or is at least part of what is going to come down. That throne room, that tabernacle, that temple in heaven, and perhaps the surrounding area, that is going to not just be out there in the spiritual realm, it's going to come down and be the actual city of God, the heavenly center of God's dwelling and operation will come to the earth. The heavenly and the earthly realm will be fused all under God's intimate and immediate presence. That's exciting. John says that this city that descends down is like a bride adorned for her husband. He reintroduces here the wedding ceremony theme. We already read about this in Revelation 19, 7 to 9, right? The marriage supper of the Lamb, this wedding type of a scenario. Exciting, intimate. It indicates a special close relationship with God and his people. And the adornment, the bride adorned for her husband, refers to an attractive, exquisite, carefully planned out presentation. And that's exactly what happens on a wedding day, isn't it? A bride never pays as much attention to how she looks as that day. And then true love is tested a week later in the morning. But that's the idea that he's trying to present. The groom stands at the front of the church, and he waits for the doors to open. That's what's happening for us in this illustration as we wait for the coming of the Lord and the new world that God is going to make. And there's coming a day that city that we know is there, that place we call heaven where God is, it is going to burst through the doors of the spiritual realm. And it'll be more attractive and exquisite and well planned out than any bride who walked through the doors of a church building. Now, John is going to actually describe a lot more about this in the rest of Revelation 21 in a future study that we will go through, as he describes this exquisite presentation, the jewels and the gold and all the things that he saw. That's what he's referring to. It is a beautiful spectacle beyond imagination. Next, in the second two verses of this chapter, an angel then explains the significance of this new creation. What are we supposed to get from what John saw, as amazing as the scene itself is? John then heard another of many loud voices from heaven, probably a reference to another angel. We've gotten quite used to loud voices yelling down from heaven in Revelation, saying some interesting things. This relocation of the city of God inaugurates the final, full, and permanent dwelling with God's people. There will no longer be a temple on earth that imitates or resembles the one in heaven. God's actual temple will move to earth. This new experience will be both permanent and personal. We will enjoy close, direct, and intimate contact and interaction with God. There are ways in which this experience is similar to the way that God interacted with, walked with Adam and Eve in the garden. But I tell you, it is far superior to that. Because we will enjoy this experience having been through all of redemptive history as a backdrop, knowing the love of God in a way displayed that Adam and Eve did not even know about. And we will do this in union with Jesus Christ. What's very interesting here is the word people. God will be with his people and will dwell with them, and he will be their God. His people. It is actually a plural, which technically could be translated as his peoples. This is borrowing from Old Testament language that was usually that way. God's people, the people of God. But that was often singular in the Old Testament, referring to the nation of Israel. To be a person of God, of faith, you had to, by faith, believe in the Messiah from Israel and submit to God's ways in Israel and become an Israelite. But the way it's described here, it sounds like the Old Testament, but it's not quite. The peoples. This is the beautiful part of this detail. The new heaven and the new earth will be made in such a way that all reflections and effects of evil, the bad parts of the past, will be removed completely. Guess what is not a bad part of now? Ethnic and racial diversity. It is such an important part of God's good and original creation that it comes back in the new creation. It doesn't go away. We retain those parts of our creation. All peoples will be the people of God. There will be no superior or singular race. All peoples, all ethnicities, all ethnic backgrounds will coalesce as the peoples of God, and we will have him in our very presence. He himself will enjoy that diversity more closely and personally than ever before, and he's been waiting a long time to do that because we messed it up before he could get started. Verse 4, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. This may be one of the most quoted and most loved verses of Revelation. We're all scared about Revelation. But then we quote this at a funeral to give comfort. So one of the most comforting verses in the Bible comes from the most scary book. This is a very special statement. The prophet Isaiah also foretold that this would happen. Isaiah 25, God will swallow up death forever. The Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. The rebuke of his people, his chastisement of his people, he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. John goes on to describe what this means, saying, there will be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying, and, well, no more pain, which causes those things. The point here is not that in the new creation with our glorified bodies, our tear ducts will no longer function. It will be the organ that God removes because it was a part of sinful existence. That is not what this is saying. There is no reason to believe that this statement, he will wipe away our tears, means we will no longer shed tears of joy and laughter or tears of worship and praise. That's why John clarifies. All tears will be wiped away, meaning these kind of tears. Tears that we shed for the reasons I am listing. Tears that we shed because of things that sin has caused and death makes us experience. Those kind of things, those kind of tears will be wiped away. Whatever experiences cause sorrowful emotions, painful feelings, will have passed away. They will no longer happen. They will no longer occur. Man alive, I am so looking forward to that. This removal of painful experiences will likely extend to our memory of painful experiences. But to clarify, this gets asked to me, someone asked me this week. When does this happen? The removal of painful memories does not seem to occur until here, at the start of the eternal state, after the lake of fire is filled, the great white throne judgment has ended, and the new heaven and the new earth are introduced. It's then that God will remove all tears of sorrow from our lives. Consider that we probably do retain our memories when we die. I say that in part because in the book of Revelation, you know as well as I know, in places like Revelation 6, 9 through 10, there are believers who were persecuted and martyred for following the Lord Jesus Christ, and they will be in heaven saying, "How long, O Lord, until you avenge our persecutors? When will you avenge our blood and judge those who were so cruel to us?" Meaning they remembered their torture, they remembered their suffering, they remembered their pain, and they wanted justice. It's not until justice has been served and all wrongs have been made right and the new state of eternity begins that those things and the memory of them will finally be erased. Finally, John points out Revelation 21, 5 through 8, something very special. Who speaks? Then he who sat on the throne said, "This is the only time," actually there are only two places in the entire book of Revelation where John says God the Father from the throne himself says something. It's usually the elders or the worshiping creatures or the angels with these loud voices all the time. It's usually that which we hear. On occasion, we get to hear the Lamb at the throne say something. But here we see the Father say something. This is the second time. The first time was Revelation 1:8. "I am Alpha, I am Omega," at the beginning of the book. At the end of the book, he says, "I am Alpha and Omega, beginning and end." He speaks, and he speaks initially in bursts with emphasis. "Behold, I make all things new." This underscores the major theme throughout Revelation, the whole point of it all. This is not just a dramatic movie for entertainment. This is what he is going to do for the very purpose of renewing what he started in the first place. "I will make all things new." John is not going in these chapters to tell us everything. He doesn't have the time or the space, and the Spirit did not inspire him to write all the things we will experience in the new world. He just tells us the things that God wanted us to know. But God also assures the curious in mind, "Don't worry, every literal thing will be made new." Everything. Meaning there will be nothing in the new earth and the new solar system that will have the fingerprints of sin and the fall. We may even perhaps in the eternal state explore the far reaches of the universe. I wouldn't mind having that job. That would be so cool. But no matter how far out we go, in that time, we will never find a consequence of sin. I was going to say, we'll never go to the farthest parts of the ocean and find, because there won't be any ocean. which itself is a vestige of the effects of sin. Then he says, write, for these words are true and faithful, emphasizing that what God had said about making all things new is fully accurate and fully reliable. There is no doubt about it. He is not saying this might happen, this will happen. Not it can happen, it will happen. He is not saying, I'll see what I can do about the problems you have down there, but rather, let me tell you what I am going to do. Verses 6 through 7, God the Father continues to speak, and he says things like, it is done. And you look around and say, no, it's not. In contemporary conversation, what this is God saying, it's as good as done. You can count on it. It's God saying, before he makes all things new, I am going to make all things new. And that is so true, it's as good as happened. This is God, as far as he is concerned, telling us this new earth, this new heaven, no matter what you do to preserve the planet you live on now, it's going to be destroyed. And what I'm going to do is a foregone conclusion. You can't stop it. By calling himself Alpha and Omega, beginning and end, of course, he repeats himself from Revelation 1:8. Christ identifies himself as the first and the last, the beginning and the end in Revelation 1:17. It reminds us that God, who is at the beginning of creation, will be there present at the end of creation. It's been a long show, but he didn't go anywhere. He was there to start it, and he'll be there to finish it at the end. We can count on that as well. Based upon his sovereign, timeless character and nature and presence, God gave John two guarantees. The first is to those who believe on him. The second is to those who do not believe on him, to those who believe on him. They're both assurances to us, but one is positive for us. The other is positive for us because it's negative to those who do not believe. The first assurance promises three things to every person who has a genuine thirst for God. Do you have a genuine thirst for God? Do you think about him often, and are you pursuing him with all of your heart? A genuine thirst for God, as John describes it, that perseveres, who overcomes, who pushes through whatever adversity you face in this fallen, messed up, crumbling world. You don't let it stop you. No matter what evil comes at you or within you, you persevere because you thirst after God and you overcome. The people who do that will find themselves in the new world. They will have, one, free access to the springs of the water of life, living water. I'm not going to talk a lot about that because in Revelation 22, first five verses, and then verse 7, we're going to talk about it again. We'll also not just have free access to the water of life, we will also have full access to the entire new creation. He will inherit all things, which means, as I understand it, all places, every square inch of the new universe, you will have access to it. If you can get there, you can be there. Doesn't that sound exciting? I get excited about that. I don't have the resources or the time to be a world globetrotter today, though it would be interesting if I had a lot of time and money. I don't. But I'll get to do that then, and you can't stop me, unless you want to come with me. I'll see if my wife, maybe we can just do all of our things together. But the kids have their own wives and husbands, but we'll go everywhere. We have access to everything. We have this idea that I think is mistaken, that someday we're going to go and forever we're just going to be in the throne room of God singing praises. Now, that is not a bad idea. That's a very good thing to want to do. But God will not be honored as he should if all we do is stay and sing praises. He made the world and the universe to glorify himself, and wherever we go, he will be there. And he wants us to see, to touch, to feel, to experience, to explore, to discover, to bring out the potential of what he made, and we will have eternity to do that. And one of the reasons I believe that the universe is measureless is because it was set up for eternal exploration. And we'll get to do that. 2 Samuel 7:14 reminds us of the third promise, the guarantee that God gives to his people. It says here in Revelation that we will be his son, our sons. And this certainly speaks of a close, intimate father-child relationship that we'll have with God, more real than we even experience now. Then that is included. But this idea of he will make us his son also has a very specific meaning, which is something like being a co-regent or ruler with, on behalf of, which is what Adam was supposed to be. Adam and Eve were supposed to be together, ruling and governing and reigning and exploring and subduing the world that God had made on behalf of God as he wanted it to be done for him. But we didn't. In the Old Testament, God chose David to govern his people Israel. And he said, I will be his father and he shall be my son. Meaning, I will be his fatherly patron king. His benevolent king, fatherly king. And he will be my son, my co-regent who will rule for me. And I will have his back because he will rule how I want him to rule, from his heart. Psalm 2:7 says the same thing about Jesus Christ. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. That is what God the Father has done through Jesus the Son and given him the kingdoms of the world on his behalf as a human being. And we will find ourselves in union with him, ruling and reigning as it should have been from the beginning over God's created world and universe. But then the final verse, the cowardly, and John lists out 8. This is not a comprehensive list. This is the kind of list. It's the kind of people, but not all the kinds of people. We will be his co-regents in this new heaven and earth. But now this but is given to us. Usually we use this verse in a gospel presentation to tell lost people, if you're like this, you won't be there. But the reason it's given here in this passage primarily is to let us know who won't be there so that we can be at ease, that we have nothing to worry about. Why don't we have anything to worry about? Because people like this won't be there, in case you were wondering. Cowardly people, and you have to put this in context. Have you ever wondered why cowardly is given? Cowardly. And why is it the first in the list? In the book of Revelation, remember, John is writing this letter to churches to encourage professing believers to stay in the race, to not be afraid, to not say, oh, there's persecution. Oh, the Jews are after me. Oh, I might die for my faith. I might be thrown to the lions. Oh, I can't do this. I'll lose my job. I won't make money. The people at the local temple will make fun of me. So I am not going to be public with my faith, which at that time would indicate you don't have genuine faith. Genuine faith rises to the occasion and perseveres to the end. But cowardly faith is no faith at all, which is why if you say you follow Christ, but you're too afraid to do anything for Christ, then you're probably not a follower of Christ at all. Which is why the cowardly don't make it to the new heaven and the new earth. They were never going there in the first place. The unbelieving refers to people who simply flat out refused to believe on Christ. They didn't pretend to. The abominable refers to people who say and do disgusting, vile, repulsive, horrid things, and likely refers to what we would call today perverted or pervert. That kind of person will not be there, thankfully. Abominable, murderers, people who take innocent lives, whether for criminal, medical, sacrificial, or vengeful purposes, whatever the cause, taking innocent life, people like that will not be there. Sexually immoral, everything from fornication to adultery to homosexuality, any other form of inappropriate sexual behavior, none of that will be anywhere in the solar system that God will make. Sorcerers, people who dispense and use drugs or black magic as a means of manipulating circumstances, controlling people, poisoning them. This is not speaking about medicine properly used. There will be none of this. Idolaters, people who worship idols, idol practices, worship anything other than God as God. Liars, people who deceive other people, live fraudulent lives, twist the truth to their own advantage. If there is a news channel in the new heaven and the new earth, everything they say will be pure truth. You won't have to worry. You won't have to be selective. It will all be true. Wow. This is a place where you can truly let down your guard because there's nothing to guard against. The list of bad people is not exhaustive, but it assures us that just as painful experiences will be removed, unpleasant people will also be removed. So, what is the key takeaway from this passage? We have a lot to look forward to. We really do. We can't get it and grab it here, but we can look forward to enjoying it there. The key is, have we trusted in Jesus Christ? And if we say we have, are we persevering in our faith through our trials, no matter what, because we're following Him to the end? I trust that this study has encouraged you, excited you about the future, and we all look forward to the day when the heavens burst apart, evil is banished, and that new city of God comes down, settles on the new earth, and we get to explore the new solar system without end because we will inherit all of it. And God Himself will be with us.